Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome. This is Straight No Chaser on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and we are broadcasting live from the back of Roberta's at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn, where brunch is now being served. My guest in studio today is the wonderfully accomplished Libby Summers. Libby is a writer, a culinary producer, and a stylist for both television and print media. Her first solo book, The Whole Hog Cookbook, which she was on the show for last year, was a National Forward Book Award finalist with accolades from the New York Times to Fox News. I'm surprised you even put that on your...
It was funny. Don't you think it was funny?
I do, yeah. And her second solo book, which will be coming out in another year, will be Sweet and Vicious, Baking with an Attitude. She also maintains a blog called Salted and Styled. And I highly recommend taking a look at Libby's... website, but don't do it when you're hungry. And Libby is coming to us from Savannah, Georgia, a Georgia peach. Yes. Are you originally from Georgia?
No, from Missouri.
Yeah.
It's the same though, right?
I don't know. I mean, I'm so unfamiliar. I don't really think of Missouri as the South.
It is. There's a ton of similarities. I don't have an accent. Most
Thank
newscasters.
God.
Katie, aside from yourself, news people apparently are from the Midwest because there's not much of an accent.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but I've been in the South long enough that I have a little bit.
Not really, though. I'm so pleased because, you know, at the risk of offending my Southern listeners, should there be any, I find that the thicker the accent, the less I trust the individual with said accent. That could be just my New York prejudice coming out. But
no, Katie, it's the truth. And I can tell you, I grew up in the same house. My older sister moved to Atlanta a few years before I did, and I don't recognize a word she says because they belong to the swim tennis club.
Oh, dear.
And I was like, I know we come from the same place. Where did this accent come
yeah,
from?
Yeah, really. But I remember when I was flacking for books. I know we're going off on a tangent here, and I do want to ask you what you've been up to. But when I was doing publicity for books, I remember calling up a paper in the South. I can't remember whether it was in Alabama or Georgia or whatever. And the girl that I was talking to eventually revealed to me that she was actually from up north, but she had a really thick Southern accent. And I said, "What's with the accent, girlfriend?" And she said, "Honey, I don't fit in without the accent. I get treated like a Yankee."
That was
good,
Katie.
Thing.
That was very designing women of you, that accent. That's nice. One of the sugar bakers.
Oh, yeah, baby. I'm a sugar baker. So anyway, now you're here in New York City for a brief visit. And tell
yes.
us what you're doing here. And also tell us about your recent trip to France, because I'm very curious about that.
I'm just here, celebrating a birthday and coming and hanging out with you. But I had some book signings. And, you know, we're still promoting the Whole Hog Cookbook. It's been doing really well. I'm really proud of it. So I'm still up here doing that and
visiting friends
and celebrating birthdays. And I stopped by David Blaine's Electrified Crazy last night.
Oh, no kidding. Where is that? I haven't seen that yet.
It's down on one of the piers in Chelsea. It's retarded.
Oh, yeah. He is such a weird retard. The last thing I saw of his was when he had the bowl, the big water bowl, the tank on Lincoln Center.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he was
yeah.
immersed in the tank for, like, you know, I don't know, 8 weeks or something. And he, I don't know how he survives this stuff, actually. I mean, it's so cockamamie. And it's really like, why?
But it's a great advertisement. I think it's an Intel kind of commercial, the whole thing, mm-hmm. but it's fantastic.
So what is he doing in this particular
He's getting
thing?
Electrified. It's like this whole young Frankenstein looking thing.
Oh my
thing.
God. So he's like twitching
and around
shaking
the world. You can send more volts to him if you want to.
Oh
and
my God.
Live tweeting going on and computers
that is so
everywhere.
So sadistic, Libby.
It's pretty cool. Apparently he's being hydrated somehow, and also he must be it's coming out too. So yeah. I was like, how are you up there? It's 3 days or three
Disgusting.
The fifth through the eighth.
I don't know. I mean, who promotes? Well, we'll talk about this after the show. I don't care about it. Anyway, so you are just back from a trip to France where you were in Paris for a few days and then you were in the country. So tell me what you were doing there and tell us about, like, what's the culinary scene in France? Like, they, what's hot there? What are the trends? Who's groovy? Who's doing something interesting?
Well, I was very lucky. I went over. I was in the Gascony area doing a food photography.
Foie gras.
I know. Yeah.
And Armagnac, right?
Oh, yes. It's all about the Armagnac and the foie gras.
Oh, man.
I was staying. There's a wonderful woman by the name of Kate Hill, who's an expat who lives just outside of Agen. She used to run a barge, and her barge is parked right outside of her old stone farmhouse. But she teaches charcuterie class and butchery class.
Cool.
And also, a few times a year, she works with a friend of hers that they do a food photography workshop, and that's how it came to be with me. I see. Soul student. His name is Tim Clinch. He's fabulous. He's a little international playboy. Was British Photographer of the Year this past year. Anyway, so I was there working with them. While I was there, which was wonderful, David Leibovitz, who's a friend of Kate's, came in for 3 days. So he was also there just kind of hanging out and getting out of Paris. So he gave me the inside scoop on where to go when I was heading back to Paris.
Awesome.
So to have that, for somebody to tell you have to eat here, I'm like, where can I get an authentic French bistro meal? Because they really are hard to find now.
Yeah, the last time I was in Paris, which was 3 years ago, I was so disappointed by the food.
You can't find it.
Just dreadful. It really was overpriced, not good. I mean, we do better here.
he was saying the same thing, but there was one place called La Biche au Bois, and it was amazing.
Really,
and it was grouse season. It just opened, so I had grouse that evening, mm-hmm. and of course, I started off with my favorite. The deviled eggs. We would think of them as deviled eggs in the States, but they're not really deviled. It's like a deconstructed deviled egg. So it's just a hard-boiled egg. Do this Thanksgiving, everyone.
Okay.
Hard-boiled egg. Instead of deviling it, leave the yolks there, and then they just pipe on this wonderful 1-inch thick layer of a very lemony mayonnaise.
Oh, wow.
And just pop it in.
Amazing.
Katie, to die for.
Really?
Like, it was heaven.
I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
I have a big party the day after Thanksgiving every year for all my friends in Rhode Island, like 25 or 30 people for dinner. I'm going to do that.
Do you call it the Thanksgiving leftover party?
No, because I don't use turkey. Turkey is off the menu in any shape or form. And there is nothing that even remotely resembles your Thanksgiving dinner so that you can go back to your leftovers the next day with pleasure.
Yes.
Because, I mean, really, 3 straight days of turkey leftovers is pretty discouraging.
Yeah, you can't eat.
I love it, but yeah.
But the countryside of France, Kate was working on a cassoulet project, so we talked a lot of cassoulet. It was fig season, pear season, so there was a lot of fig jam making. I asked her what I could bring her from the States, and you'll love this. She said, can you bring me some grits?
Of course.
Yes.
Yeah.
So she made a huge breakfast Sunday morning, and it had everything, because none of the other people had ever had grits, and she made a nice brown gravy, like a sawmill gravy, and it was just...
What's a sawmill gravy?
It's like, you know, milk and with bacon fat and just your basic...
So it's a white...
Yes.
It's like a bechamel.
Yes.
Milk sauce.
Huh. Yes, but with all that great...
What's red-eye gravy?
I don't know. What's in red-eye gravy?
I don't know. I thought that was like ham drippings.
It is, isn't it?
And bake and milk and butter. Ham drinking milk and fat. Flour.
Would the red-eye gravy not have the milk in it? I think maybe it doesn't have milk.
So it would just be
drippings? Do they do it with like some stock or something? Who knows?
Really?
Well, I don't know.
We'll have to look that up.
I don't know.
That's what Google is for.
Yes.
So let me ask you this about the French culinary scene, and then we'll move on to something else. One of the things that the French have always done is something that we're rediscovering in this country, which is that sort of artisanal locavore thing. They've never transported their vegetables very far. France is smaller than Texas, after all. And they've never gone away from artisanal production. But when you were there, did you see more of a retrenchment into the traditional, or were they doing traditional with a more contemporary forward-thinking twist, or are they just kind of doing their thing the way they've always done it?
Well, in my opinion, I think they're doing their thing in the countryside the way they've always done it, which is the reason why people love France and their resistance to change. And that's why, as much as we, I don't want to say hate the French, because that's not
true.
Them,
but yeah,
as long as
they're great,
we still have that kind of, you know, friction with the French, but there's a reason why they're so steadfast in the way they do things, and it's why we embrace it so much and why we're so enamored with it. Everything where I was in the country was all, you know, farm to table, and even the charcuterie, these wonderful families that make all the charcuterie in the area, where they call it seed to sausage.
Mm-hmm.
So they are doing
nice.
Everything. They're growing the charcuterie hogs that they are mm-hmm. slaughtering. And
yeah.
Everything. I mean, we took big old bottles to the farmer's market to fill with rosé. And
oh, I love that. I remember going to a place where you actually went to, it was basically the equivalent of a gas pump.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's so cool.
Exactly.
That just blew my mind. You take a 5-liter container to a gas pump and you pump your wine out of an underground storage tank.
Yes.
It was the, okay, I think we should do that. And it costs, $2 a liter
or something.
It was
nothing. Yeah. It was pennies.
And it's really good.
It was pennies.
So building on that idea of like of people sort of staying true to their traditions, et cetera, I know that the South is making quite a comeback in their culinary sort of, shall we say, the way the rest of the country is becoming interested again in Southern cooking.
Yes. The South is the new black, Katie.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah, well, that's what they say. That's what you'd like to think.
It is. Southern cooking is the new... I mean, when Marcus Samuelson opens a Southern influence restaurant
in Harlem,
I mean, come on.
Yeah, but that's because he's preaching to basically a Southern traditional audience.
True.
I mean, the population in Harlem, there's a lot of people who came up from the South.
True.
Yeah. Yeah. For instance, my favorite bum locally on the Upper West Side. I've known this guy for over 30 years. Isn't that the weirdest thing? I mean, I'll just digress for a second.
My favorite bum.
Well, you know, I mean, when you live in the same neighborhood for a long time in New York, just like you know your shopkeepers, you know your
yes.
bums, right? So when I was working as a butcher in the, you know, late 80s, early 90s, there was a guy who was kind of shapeless and ageless and formless, but he was always exposing himself. And he was always panhandling out in front of our butcher shop, which was like this very cute little French joint on 90th Street and Broadway. And we would go out and be like, Jesus, man, would you just put that thing away? You're scaring the customers. Anyway, so in subsequent years, I've run into the man again and again and again, and in varying states of disarray on his part. So sometimes he's quite pulled together, and sometimes he's really sick. And so the other day I ran into him, and I'd just been having dinner with my butcher friends. And I was riding on the bus, and he's on the bus. He's like, hey, miss. So I was kind of drunk. So I sat down with him. He was totally tidied up. I mean, you know, he still looked a little nutty, and he has no teeth. His teeth are just like, oh my God, oh my God. It turns out, first of all, that he must have been in his 20s. We thought he was like 50.
No.
Yeah. He has no wrinkles and just a few gray hairs now. And he's lost all his teeth. He must have been a really bad crackhead. His name is Benjamin Doctor. He was no longer showing me his thing. So anyway, we had this long conversation, and he was from North Carolina.
What was he doing in New York? Why do people come to be homeless where it's cold?
I don't know. I would be homeless in a warm state. I would. I'd be homeless in Florida.
I have been homeless in a warm state.
Oh, please don't tell me
kidding.
That.
No.
Anyway, to go back, I mean, I'm sorry about all these digressions. I really shouldn't do this. But tell me about the ways that Southern traditions, and I'm not just talking about grits and black-eyed peas. I'm talking about like core Southern traditional dishes, and are they staying true to their core? Are they going back to their core on a certain level because of the, you know, new interest in growing your own hogs locally and butchering your own hog, making your own charcuterie, blah, blah, blah? Or are they progressing into something new while staying grounded in that old tradition?
I think it's a little bit of both. You know, Southern cooking has gotten a bad rap for a lot of different reasons. But
fatties.
You know, traditionally, Southerners, the same as Midwesterners, we've always eaten seasonally. And this bad rap that they haven't eaten seasonally is BS.
Well, what about the lard quotient there? I mean, I gained 10 pounds on a 5-day visit to Pensacola, Florida from eating.
What were you eating?
Traditional fried chicken.
Well, no one eats that every day. Well, you were eating it every day because you were on vacation.
I guess so, yeah.
I mean, the tradition of pickling, like I'm really inspired by all the, you know, the pickling and putting up of things, that mm-hmm. resurgence of that. Because you know, my grandmother did that. My mother did not do that. Mm. I am doing that. Mm. So I think it's just this generational thing, and now this awareness of all that. And people, so, but I think they're, for example, doing pickling, but putting their own fabulous twist on it. If it's, you know, some kind of jalapeno spice pickle that your grandmother would have never made.
Right.
Yeah, they're wonderful Southern, you know, chefs that are putting twists on old favorites. I mean, I was at Husk probably a month ago, and Katie, you could not have this all the time, but it was the fried chicken skins appetizer that Sean Brock was doing with his own house-made hot sauce that he served
yum.
With it. So you dip it in this like wonderful kind of buffalo-y hot sauce.
Oh, baby.
Yeah, you wouldn't have that all the time, and it was a very small portion, and it was, you know, it was kitschy, but I think that we always have eaten seasonally, and that's how most Southerners eat. We don't have fried chicken every day. And,
yeah.
And because the Food Network might have shown that, because it's a show, that's also, you know, a New York production company that might be writing those recipes. Let's not forget. It's not always the Southerner that does it.
I guess that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
So we have hit the halfway mark here, and Joe is going to do a quick sponsor drop for us, and we'll come right back with Libby Summers, the fabulous stylist, author, culinary producer, et cetera, all around good time, as I like to say. And so, folks, do stay tuned for the rest of this show, because it should be a lot of fun.
Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surreyfarms.com.
And are we back? Yes, we are. And you are listening to Straight No Chaser on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. And in the studio with me is the wonderful Libby Summers, who is an accomplished writer. She wrote the Whole Hog Cookbook. She is a culinary producer and a stylist for both television and print media. And boy, you wrote the book on style and girl, I got to say. I mean, your food styling is just
Thank you, Katie. Exquisite.
No, it really is beautiful. I mean, I worked on a lot of books when I was doing book publicity. I worked with Donna Hay. I worked with Rachel Ray. I worked with a lot of people
beautiful
who
books.
Are really good at making books. Lots of Clarkson Potter books. Yeah.
Gorgeous books. Yes.
Yeah. 10 Speed. I mean, all the big cookbook publishers. I can see why they hire you. Anyway, so now you are working, speaking of books, nice segue.
Katie, you're working that on was a, genius.
Sometimes I surprise myself. Now you're working on a new book about baking. Let's hear about it.
A Sweet and Vicious, Baking with an Attitude.
Yeah. So what kind of... Need I ask what attitude?
It is going to be the best. I'm so excited about this book. Like, really excited about this book. Well, now we're in the middle of finishing recipe testing. We actually start shooting the book at the end of this month, so in 2 weeks. And Katie will appreciate that. It's they're fun. Everything I do is like home cooking recipes.
Right.
I will give you a couple of stretches, but I want it to be accessible to everyone.
Sure, so you don't need fancy equipment to be
absolutely
able to follow these
not.
Recipes.
Absolutely
right.
Not. But they're fun flavor twists mm-hmm. on traditional recipes, or it's doing something with a traditional... If it's a vanilla cake, Katie, it's going to be the best vanilla cake, and it's going to have some crazy other aspect to it. For example, mine, it's called a fairground attraction cake.
Nice.
Great band, by the way, from the late 80s. and it is this wonderful vanilla cake, but it happens to be piled to the ceiling with cotton candy that comes all the way off of it. Like, it's just, and it's so simple. Like, everything is very simple, but it's very theatrical, kind of. And a lot of hot and sweet and sour and sweet. A lot of candy-inspired recipes, because I have a big sweet tooth.
Do you?
Like a lemon head cake. There might be some Good and Plenty cupcakes, kind of ish. Some anise cupcakes.
Well, I love that flavor. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I tend to drink my calories, so I don't have as much of a sweet tooth as I used to, but I certainly know plenty of people who would enjoy this. What do you think makes it really different from other baking books?
Well, I tell you, I was on a shoot in Milwaukee for a few weeks doing some stuff for Kohl's, actually, Food Network product, and Bobby Flay has a new line of beautiful products at Kohl's, and we were there shooting. So at night, of course, I'm there with all this time on my hands. So I went to the big bookstore and pulled every baking book off the shelf, because I needed to like hone in on the inspiration of the visual of this book, because it's so much of what I do too. And Katie, they all kind of, to me, they have a lot of similarities. They're beautiful, beautiful books.
Yeah, the photography is always
my
really
gosh.
Good.
Just gorgeous books, but they all kind of have that same aesthetic. And I knew that this baking book was not going to be a traditional kind of baking book. And plus, it's going to have some, you know, my mouth inside of it, too, with the writing. It really helped me kind of pinpoint how I knew we wanted to shoot it, which is going to be in a very editorial way and much more.
What do you mean by that?
Well, one image in particular I can tell you, I have something called a dude's cookie, an aficionado cookie, as it were. It's like a guy's bourbon cookie.
Cool.
And I've invited all my favorite kind of best-dressed guys, my favorite guys in Savannah, and a few that are flying in to kind of do this sartorialist kind of shoot with that cookie.
Oh, nice.
Very Vanity Fair kind of.
How funny.
Bit, you know, but there's still a bunch of guys sitting around eating cookies.
Yeah.
Like, it's still that. But these are these great looking guys.
They're all dressed up.
Yeah, and I'm not
beautiful.
I'm not informing anything about. I want them to come how they normally would come if they were getting dressed up or doing something. Mm-hmm. I will tell you that one of them asked if he's flying in. It's a wonderful photographer friend of mine, Ben Fink, who lives here in the city. He's flying in. He's like, "Can you have a lowboy Harley Davidson there for me?" I was like, "Yeah, sure, Ben. Whatever you want, we'll have
it. You want to eat cookies on a motorcycle, dude?
Sure.
I'm all over that."
But it's that kind of thing. Like, it's the fairground attraction cake we're actually shooting at a carnival.
Excellent.
When, you know, we're just taking it out, because that's what I do for a living, too. I want it. It's all about the food still, but bigger.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that actually is the perfect segue to talking about your work as a stylist and a little bit about what we were talking about before the show, which is you have a whole perception that is informed by food that doesn't stop at the borders of the table or the stove. It goes on to inform dress and decor, furniture, I suppose, or color schemes, or whatever it is, what you call lifestyle. Let's talk a little bit about that, how you translate what you do in the realm of food into the rest of your lifestyle, and how you see that as kind of a vision that you have that isn't so limited as most people think of who are cookbook authors. They don't really have a vision beyond the stove. You have a much greater vision. What is that?
Well, I do, and thanks for asking. It's something that people brought to me because I guess that I had always said before, if I was trying to explain something to someone, I would say, well, you know, it's that brown-black color. It's that strie that goes up the side of a pecan, right, you know, when it falls from the tree. Or it's that bumpling effect that it's on a clementine when it's, you know, it's been picked a little too early. Or, you know, I always reference something with food, if it's a color of my dress or if it's a wallpaper that I want to use, or, you know, something that I might be doing when I'm styling a set or styling food. And it just, I realize that food, what I put in my mouth, informs everything creatively in my life. And that's kind of what we're doing, that my photographer friend Chia Chong and I have on our website, Salted in Style. We take this food item each week and we let it inform everything for the week. If it's a floral arrangement, if it's artwork, if it's a table setting, if it's a story, I do a lot of like behind the scenes kind of stories. We'll take a picture and I'll build the story around it, or I'll build a story before we go and shoot it. So the wonderful women who work with us, because it's a team collaborative effort, because I always think it's better if more people are involved.
Sure.
And it's just that. It's something I might sketch on a piece of muslin fabric and want to work in a picture because I saw the side of a strawberry, and I don't, it's a sickness, Katie. I'm sick. I'm sick.
I don't know if it's sick. Maybe a little obsessive compulsive.
It is. I mean, I'll wake up in the middle of the night. Ask my husband. I keep, you know, you always, like music people, keep a tablet by their bed. I will like write some crazy thing. I'll be on a train. We did a whole story on onions, spring onions, and white lace because I had this vision on the train going into Philadelphia for a book signing about white lace and spring onions.
Really?
It's sick, Katie.
Yeah. Well, I can kind of relate. I'm having a little bit of that moment with fabrics right now.
I see that. Katie's wearing a gorgeous scarf that's a variety of fabrics. All silk,
it's
looks
a couple
like.
Of, it's two different fabrics, and this is my first effort. But anyway, we'll talk about it afterwards. But I am like a total fabric junkie, and I always have been. But I finally got my sewing machine out and bought some equipment, and I'm like, I'm in
sewing.
Production now. I'm
Ew.
In production. I actually kind of like it. I like ironing, too. I mean, I
love...
Isn't that sick? I hate every other form of domestic labor, but I love to cook and I love to sew. And I haven't sewn in 30 years.
Did you have to take like a home ec class?
No, I did not. And I actually think that people should be obliged to take home ec. It's one of my pet hobby horses on this program, is bringing home ec back into the school system. And not just for girls, for boys too. Because I think everybody needs the rudimentary elements of cooking, keeping a checkbook. You know, and home ec doesn't have to be limited to just girly stuff. I mean, it could include some vocational stuff like, I don't know, light carpentry or, you know, just things so you don't have to call somebody in and pay them $75 an hour to mount a cabinet or build a shelf.
Right.
Everybody needs to know how to do that stuff. And we have so gotten away from that. And not that I don't, you know, that I begrudge anybody who does that for a living, but believe me, you don't have to spend $75 an hour to be that.
I was at the Marimekko store yesterday looking at some fabric because their fabric occasionally, and I ended up buying this shirt, and when I was checking out, the girl had the audacity. You would have loved her, Katie, because she said, you know what, this shirt responds well to an iron. And I said, that makes one of us. Who would say, like, that was, she's folding it up. She says, you know, this shirt responds well to an iron.
That's a very interesting way of putting it, too, responds well.
I almost handed it back to her. I'm like,
yeah, that will never happen in my household. So just saying, you just,
unless it plugs it in and rubs it on itself, no, it's not going to happen.
That will happen in the future, though. Now, tell me, what is the hardest thing? We only have a few more minutes. I wanted to kind of get down to, like, how did you, you know, to go back to your sort of aesthetic vision about everything from food to, you know, tableware to fabrics, blah, blah, blah. How did you get your start? Like, where did you start with this? And, you know, you started as a, did you start as a stylist?
Well, I started cooking in the yachting industry, which I still actually cook for one gentleman a couple weeks out of the year.
No kidding.
Yes.
Nice.
And on boats of a certain size, which are 100 and under sailboats, which I worked on primarily in that, you know, 65-70 range. Everything is done, you know, it's a party every night and everything. So I'm always throwing parties and always trying to, I think it all started there. And then I ended up landing in Savannah and started food styling, and then, you know, worked in television. And
you
just
were food styling for media, for like newspapers there?
I took every job I could just to get my foot into it for free. I did everything I could for free.
Wow.
I laugh about the first job I went on, Katie. I had this big old kit. Like, I thought, now I travel with a tweezer and a spray bottle. Like, I don't need any of that crap. I style very naturally. But I had read everything online, and I needed all this stuff. It was like I needed a truck to get in all my food styling equipment to this burger job. And on my website to this day, there's one shot from that very first shoot that I did that I refused to take off. It's a burger. And I've since styled burgers for big corporations.
I might have seen that shot because I think I saw that burger shot.
I keep it on there because it was the first shoot I ever did.
Also really appetizing.
Well, thank you. I look at it now beautiful. With a discerning eye and say, oh my God, that is the worst style burger ever. But it's just, it's personal and I will not take it off the site.
Well, I wondered how you'd gotten the edges of the burger so deliciously and fabulously brown without looking flattened.
That is, well, you know when you do a burger.
Use a blowtorch?
No, that was probably hand-painted on with Kitchen Bouquet. That's the secret of the South, speaking the devil. Yeah. And you know when burgers, when we do them for commercials, they actually were deep-fried really quickly, flash-fried, so you get that kind of crisp, and then I go in and paint.
I think a lot of people actually do that in the restaurant industry. I've talked to a bunch of chefs because, you know, I write for Food Arts also, and I did a piece on steaks and burgers and blah, blah, blah. And a lot of people were doing that. They were flash frying their burgers in deep fat, and then they would either cook it in a sous vide in a plastic thing, or they would cook it sous vide until it was the right temperature and then flash fry it so it looked nice. Yeah,
but that's how we do it for camera.
Very interesting. And what has changed? Unfortunately, we have to wrap this up, but I mean, God, I could have gone on and on with you, honey. what has changed in the industry since you started out? Like
food styling?
Yeah, like, is there more work? Is there less work? Is it more natural or less natural?
I think that there's a lot of people who, you know, they've got a blog and they take a picture and they styled it, or they went to a workshop once and now they're a food stylist, but, and God bless them, keep doing it. I mean, it's no different than me going to take every first job, but I think there's a lot of people now in the industry, but part of it, it's not only having the ability to style, it's kind of this unflappability that you have to have when you're on set and working. I work with, you know, a bunch of celebrity cookbook stuff. Sure. And, you know, you just have to, I always make sure that it's their book. And I know that firsthand it's their book. I want it to be exactly how you want it to be. Mm-hmm. I want this article to be exactly how you want it to be because it's your name on it. Yeah. I'm styling it, but it's your food. And I think sometimes stylists come in with an attitude of they want it to be their way.
I have a look.
Yeah, well, forget the look. The look needs to be the client's look.
Right. But that's an interesting balance to strike because on the one hand, you want to keep getting work and you want to show that you have a style, I would imagine.
I do that on my blog. I save that for personal things that people look at.
So when you show a portfolio, you're showing a variety of different ways you can work as opposed to like, here's what I can do.
I will tell you, Katie, I just did not get a job recently because I have nothing in my portfolio that's healthy. And I put that in air quotes. But you don't have healthy styling stuff. I'm like, well, what do you need?
Yeah, I mean, what is healthy? Can you tell me what that's supposed to look like?
Three radish slices and a bean sprout on a plate? Yeah. No, I don't have that in my portfolio.
Oh, and by the way, don't eat sprouts.
Why?
Because they are vectors for foodborne disease.
Is that true?
Yes, ma'am. Not so much any sprout that you don't cook, absolutely a vector for disease.
I did not know that.
Yes, ma'am, because that growing medium, the water, is like the perfect solution in which to develop E. coli and Salmonella. So if you remember last year, this is like my favorite story, but in Germany last year, something like 47,000 people became ill and nearly 4,000 people died from eating sprouts. The seeds were contaminated. They came from Egypt. They were sprouted in Germany. And people all across Europe got sick. And first they pointed the finger at Spanish cucumbers, and the Spanish agricultural market took the biggest hit. And then it turned out it was these freaking
sprouts.
Seeds from Egypt, because the seeds become contaminated and it's very hard to clean them.
Very rarely do I eat
a sprout. Do not eat a sprout. I think they should be banned myself. I mean, sorry to the people who are in the sprout business.
Katie,
I feel sorry for you.
Just made my day.
I know, because everybody eats them because they think they're supposed to, but they're really not that good, are they?
Thank God I don't have to eat another sprout.
I said that to another friend of mine. He was like, God, what a relief. I hate the damn things, but I always think I'm doing something good for my body. You're not. You're exposing yourself to disease.
It's so good to know.
So we have to wrap it up. Unfortunately, we're even over time here. Thank you so much.
Thanks
for coming out. This was so great. People, check out the book, Whole Hog Cookbook. It's on every bookstore and Amazon, et cetera, et cetera. And then look for, what
Sweet
is it called?
And Vicious, Sweet Baking and with Vicious. An Attitude. Yeah. It's September 2013, that's another Rizzoli book.
And it's a Rizzoli book, so you know the quality, the values are going to be great. And next week, folks, we have a really interesting guest. Dr. Richard Raymond will be joining us. Dr. Raymond is the former Undersecretary for Food Safety in the USDA from 2005 to 2008, and he works as a food safety and public health consultant primarily to the cattle industry. Oh, yeah. We're going to go to town on Dr. Raymond. So thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you next week. And again, thanks to my sponsor and to my wonderful engineer, Joe. This has been Straight No Chaser with Katie Kiefer and Libby Summers. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.